often what I will do is read the material and then kind of paraphrase the material into a language that makes sense to me, and I'll share it that way. When I tried to do that with this particular material from Laborers in the Lord's Vineyard, which is my topic, I really struggled with that because I couldn't find better words than what were in the document. So Pope John Paul the Great, St. John Paul the Great, has such a way with words that anytime I would try to distill it down into something of my own vocabulary, it felt like I was not doing it justice, right? So the approach that I've taken here is to highlight some of the nuggets in each of these sections. It's a fairly long section, so I encourage you to read it on your own. I can distill it down into a couple words, which is none of you are off the hook. Basically, it doesn't matter what your state in life is, he's exhorting us to evangelize in our own way, in our own circles. And like Father David Ender said this morning, that's our job, right? Because we can get access to places the priests can't, right? They can't get into my business at work, my work business. They can't get into some of these other places, your backyard cookouts with your friends, your social circles. They're not there. You are. And so regardless of whether we feel equipped or called, if there's any question, you've been called. But he has such a gift for the written word. It's just incredible to read through and chew on it and take your time. Don't read it like you're trying to get to the end. Read it to really understand the word. So I'm going to high spot a few things here. And then I have a bit of a witness that I think will help bring this home. So bear with me if it looks like I'm reading, because I usually don't do too much of that. But in the first section here, called Laborers in the Lord's Vineyard, it starts by going back to the gospel passage that Mary Beth talked about last night, and where the landowner goes out to recruit employees. And some people are left at the end of the day. They end up getting the same wage. And you know that story. A part of that story that seemed kind of weird to me is that when he goes at the end of the day, he's saying, why are you still here? Why have you been here idle all day? So it's not like he came at dawn, brought people in, went back, and there were more people gathered. These were the same people. The people that were there at 5 o'clock, you find out later, they were there all day. So why didn't they respond to the first call, or the second, or the third, or the fourth call? Are we those folks? Are we there idle all day, and we say nobody hired us? Well, you were invited, right? And so that's the message I think we take away from this section, is we're invited. You know, the door will open. We have to go through that door. So none of us gets a free pass and you know, can sit back and say, well, it's somebody else's job. It's somebody else who's more knowledgeable about the Bible, more knowledgeable about their faith. We're called, and God equips the called. He doesn't only call the equipped, all right? So that's kind of the message in this first section, is he's exhorting all of us, regardless of where we are in our faith journey, where we are at what stage of our life. And so he drills into these different sections, talks about different stages of life, talks about young people. So it says the church calls them the hope of the church, the youth. Right? It says they're not just a object of pastoral concern, people who need us. They are called to evangelize, and they are leading characters in evangelization, according to the Pope. My experience is that youth are powerful voices, especially in, say, the pro-life movement. If you've ever gone to the March for Life in DC, if you've ever seen that on TV, it's broadcast on EWTN each year. The predominance of attendees in the tens of thousands are youth. They're passionate about that topic. Another example is we have four children. One of our children is a full-time missionary, Teresa. Many of you know Teresa. She was married this summer after 2 years as a focus missionary at the University of Toledo. She met her husband. He was attending the focus missionary activities, the Bible studies at church. And their relationship was so profound, he decided, even though he has an engineering degree, he just graduated, he wanted to become a focus missionary. And she has a medical degree. So they both gave up these very lucrative secular jobs or job opportunities to go be full-time focus missionaries, which is powerful enough in itself. They were assigned to the University of Northern Iowa. So they just started there this this fall. And when I asked her, you know, what was that like? What was that? Because was it like the University of Toledo? Was the school community receptive to the missionaries? You know, because we hear all these stories about people losing their faith in college and how it's the belly of the beast. And, you know, the liberal teachings are anti-church in so many of their institutions. And she said, oh, yeah, we have 60 or so already at the University of Iowa waiting for us. And I'm thinking, well, 60 participants in college is pretty good. She said, oh, no, we have 60 Bible study leaders in the student community. So there's one that's on the girls volleyball team. There's one on the track team, and there's one for the chess club. And this is very powerful. They have been very active out there, and that's a great testimony. Now they do these retreats. They go to these international retreats at times, and there's thousands of kids coming from all over the country, from colleges to these. So if you get an opportunity to support a focus missionary, do it. It's the best money you'll ever invest. We're so proud of them and just thrilled for their future. They're really carrying out the Pope's exhortation here. So as it moves on, talks much more about children. I'll let you read that. But then he goes to the other end of the spectrum. He talks about the elderly. Talks about older people and the gift of wisdom. And he references the synod statements throughout this. He says, the elderly are rich in wisdom and fear of the Lord. They're a witness to tradition. I'm jumping around a little bit. These aren't all consecutive thoughts here. But he says, they're teachers of the lessons of life. And they're the workers of charity. And then he kind of challenges them a little bit, too. He says, well, just because you're old, there's a temptation to take refuge in the nostalgia about the past and that the good times won't return. And in doing so, you may be fleeing from your present responsibility because of difficulty, health difficulties or mobility difficulties. He says the elderly must always have a clear knowledge that one's role in the church and society does not stop at a certain age. You don't graduate and now it's, you know, free ride and it's somebody else's turn. So actually arriving at an older age is considered a privilege in the church. And we are called to become an example of the church. They're participants at a time of life which is humanly and spiritually fruitful. They have a mission to fulfill and a contribution to make. So there's no rest for the retired, right? We're called as well. Then there's quite a lengthy section on women and men. And I started highlighting, and then this section started looking like, did you ever get a used textbook? It was just so highlighted you couldn't even read the words. Why bother highlighting it all if you highlight everything? But it's interesting because I felt like as I read this section, at times the Pope was almost apologizing for the church's language around or the role of women in the church. And so it seemed like he was going overboard, things that seemed like he was preaching to the choir here. You know, there's no inequality in our view, but he goes into some detail explaining how rather than defining the role of women and what it's not, like not the priesthood, for instance, he talks about what it is and the beauty and the necessity, and he uses examples like the Blessed Virgin Mary. And she wasn't a priest. She had a pretty big role, right? Still has a pretty big role. And then I gave thought to Saint Therese, right? She wasn't a priest either. But what an amazing example of loving through small things and giving us that understanding that when we evangelize, it's not, our role isn't to find a target, say, okay, I'm going to evangelize that one over there. And like we throw our fishing line at them, hook them and reel them in. And we gut them and we have a nice dinner. That's not how it works. Maybe once in a while you can complete the entire process, but more often we're called to just participate in some small way in that person's sanctification. So God's working on all of us, including that person. And there are other people that interact in that person's life. So we just have to say yes and step forward. And maybe just, I used the example earlier today, maybe a person sneezes saying, God bless you. That might get their attention. I've seen an example where that causes some wonderment. Like, why would you say that? And it could be small things like that add up and make the person feel welcome at the church. So we have to invite. We have to continue to, even if the invitations aren't accepted, continue to invite. Maybe it's the fourth one that gets accepted. Same mother, Teresa of Calcutta, is another one. Very humble, but very powerful in the impact she had on the world. With her example, she wasn't a priest. So rather than dwell on, what certain denominations say, well, the role of the woman should include the priesthood, and why doesn't it, and create a bunch of controversy there, he sums up this section with a pretty simple conclusion. It says, we can't change what Jesus did, right? He created the apostles, or he gathered the apostles, turned the church over to Peter and the line of succession of the popes. And he had his reasons for doing that. And so we shouldn't be changing that. We shouldn't worry about that. There's so much more work for all of us to do. And he talks about, the role of women as evangelists, and starts in the family, starts with their spouse. We did a retreat years ago out in Peebles. I think it was a married couple retreat. And Nancy and I were in charge of that one. And I had the closing talk. And one of the things, we had it set up like a wedding. We reenacted a wedding. And so I forced all the guys to get up and dance with their wife, because that's what you do at a wedding. But the song we danced to was from a popular Christian band called Mercy Me. You've ever heard their music. It's one of my favorite bands. But the song I chose was called You're to Blame. Right. And I'm always joking around with Nancy, teasing her. And she does such great work that it's up to me to keep her humble. So I'm always telling her that, she's really made it easy for me to get into heaven, because I'm doing all my penance in purgatory here on earth. And I know that when I, St. Peter's at the pearly gates, and he's, got a long line in front of me, and he's going to say, hey, you bald guy in the back, come on, easy pass. You did your time with Nancy. But she knows I'm always teasing her about it. But it's such a powerful thing to have a loving marriage, that you can be an example to others, and you still go through your daily struggles. And it's just, it's such a powerful witness, and we never know who's watching. But we used to do a marriage ministry years ago for engaged couples. And we would talk with them about some of the church's teachings. And they're coming from all types of backgrounds. Oftentimes there's one Catholic, and the other engaged partner is not Catholic. Maybe they're living together. And so we're talking to them about that. Right? We're talking about how that's not how you start a marriage, because you're saying, by doing that sex outside of marriage is okay. You're evidence of that right now, right? So we would encourage them to go, one of them move out back with the parents, or live as brothers and sisters for the months leading up to the marriage, as a sign of their commitment. And there's so many little things we can do. It doesn't have to be in a formal setting. If you have, you know, a couple that you know are living together and they're not married, don't shy away from that conversation. Don't just sneer or you know, say that, you know, they shouldn't be doing that. Talk with them and explain. And if you don't feel equipped, pray over it. The Lord will give you the right words. But husbands and wives have a great role in evangelization within the family, in many ways outside the family, if you're willing to step out. So that's what that whole section talked about, the collaboration of men and women. The next section he talks about is the sick and the suffering. And I found this section very interesting in that we feel empathy for the sick and for suffering. We've all been there, right? We've all struggled with various health ailments, either personally or with other family and friends. They're not off the hook either, right? There's a special redemptive suffering that we can offer our illness, our sickness, our pains to Jesus on the cross. And while we're praying for somebody else. And that's very powerful, rather than focus internally on my own ailments and my limitations or my fears, my anxiety about my health. If I'm ill, I can offer that up. I can be an example of suffering with grace and with humility and not stop evangelizing. There's a book, Father Jim Willey was a priest that was a pastor in Reading, Ohio, that we used to attend his masses. And he was diagnosed with cancer in his 40s, passed away, I think it was early 50s, yeah, age 50, a very young priest. It was just so hard to understand. He was so wonderful, so filled with joy. And he said, well, why would God allow that to happen? You know, his work was not finished. He was just starting. It was a thriving parish. And he had such a message of love. And Romans 8:28, right, tells us God does all things for good, can turn all things for good. And how's he going to turn this into good? But we, you know, he left a legacy, right, Father Jim did. And, you know, his words and his example, and he wrote a book. If you know anybody suffering from cancer, it's called Lessons from the School of Suffering. It's a very small book that Cami Bundy helped him write. And it's all about the other people who don't have cancer. It's about how the suffering individual can help the other family members who feel powerless, who feel, you know, anxious and fearful, and their faith can be shattered at that time. And he talks about how the person with cancer often is the first one to accept it. And they are drawn to their faith. They can be drawn closer to the faith because they realize their time might be limited. But this book can help the rest of the family either deepen their faith or improve their prayer life or be more comfort of others. So even the sick, you know, he was on his deathbed and he's writing these books. So even the sick are not absolve from the responsibility for evangelization. It says, Christ himself, who is the good Samaritan, who does not pass by, but has compassion on him. So I thought that was a beautiful line in there. He talks about the untiring commitment of all those who have taken care of the sick and of healthcare workers. So that sick person by not being miserable, but by allowing others to help. That's an act of mercy and evangelization by accepting the assistance rather than resisting it, thinking you can do everything for yourself. It says, in the sixth, says the call becomes the living sign of Jesus Christ and his church in showing love towards the sick and suffering. So we all have a role to play there, and most of us will encounter that stage in life, and it's up to us to recall we still have a role to play even when we're sick. He has a section here on pastoral action, and it talks about how priests can encourage the evangelization. And face it, priests have a very tough life, right? Many of them are spread very thin. It's hard for them to do anything beyond the normal daily and weekly grind of their schedule. And they need our help to evangelize. You know, they can't get out and reach out to those folks. So we have to invite. We have to continue to do that and to be a good example to others so they feel welcome in our churches and don't feel like they have to reach a certain level of holiness before they dare open the doors. What's the phrase? It's not a museum for saints. The church isn't a museum for saints. It's a hospital for sinners. Come on, join us right in the front row. Right? We're all there. So I think the last section in this piece is the various vocations in the lay state. So I'll touch on that a little more specifically. It says each state of life creates diverse vocations. These are given. There are different paths in the spiritual life and the apostolate, which are taken by individual members. So as we journey through these stages of life, the earlier we start, the more equipped we feel later to talk about our faith, to witness it, to accept that we don't have all the answers and we don't have to have all the answers. If we're challenged by, say, somebody who's anti-Catholic, I've run into those folks, you probably have as well. We can just accept their confusion and their contempt for the church and ignore it and feel like we can't reach that person. Or we can probe into it and not like we have to get into an argument and defend our faith necessarily, but I've been in a situation where I'll say, well, tell me what you believe. Tell me what you understand. You're here attacking the church, but where do your beliefs come from? And they don't usually have a whole lot to say. So it can help to engage those folks. And if you get stumped, if they ask a question that you don't understand the answer to, then there's resources. We'll cover a few here shortly. You can go research that and come back and talk to them later. Don't have to feel like you have all the answers. Says no talent, no matter how small, is to be hidden or left unused. So if you don't think you have much to offer, guess what? You've got plenty to offer. God's equipped you with exactly what you need for this calling. Says the Apostle Peter gives us a stern warning, and this is how he closes this section. It says, as each has received a gift, employ it for one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. So we're all called to this. So in how we live out that calling brought a couple memories to my life in terms of situations I've encountered, many from my work life. I think these examples are from my work life. So years ago, I worked for a company called Standard Register in Dayton. I was a president of one of their divisions, a big division, about $800 million, about 5,000 employees. And it was about 80% of the whole company. So I had a pretty big job at that company. And at the time, I'd only been there a couple months. And through my morning routine, went down to our coffee shop, got a cup of coffee, and was walking back to my office to start the daily grind. And we had a long hallway, kind of like this, only was much longer, so you could see people coming. And it was early, and there was not too many people in the building. And I'm walking down this hallway and just kind of lost in my thoughts. And a person approached me. I didn't recognize. I had never seen this person before. And she stops me in the hallway. It's probably 7 o'clock in the morning. And she points at me. And she says, "You're Catholic, aren't you?" And I was really surprised. I didn't know what triggered that. First thought was, "Is it Ash Wednesday?" And I thought, is my crucifix outside my tie? I got my tie on in the car while I was driving. Where did that come from? So I didn't know. I said, "Yes, good morning. I am Catholic. Why do you ask?" She says, I said, "Have we met?" She said, "No, I don't work in your division." "You're not from around here, are you?" I said, "Yeah, well, I live about a half hour away. It's That's not what I meant. You're a lot like the rest of the people around here. And I said, I don't know. I never really thought of that. But she said, I heard about you. I'm thinking, you've heard about me. And she said, yeah, I'm going to be watching the job postings for a job in your division. So just thought I'd give you a heads up. It was the strangest conversation. I said, that's terrific. Spread the word. You know, we're hiring. Wasn't sure what else to say. She just caught me totally off guard. And I hadn't been there that long. So I don't, but I did something, or I was doing something right that was enough conversation that I was having a positive influence there. I still don't to this day know what caused that reaction. But, you know, I was never really outgoing with my Catholicism. I just tried to be a good employee, be a good leader. I talk about things that I didn't think would drive people away. So I would talk about doing the right thing. I talk about operating principles and values and treating customers right and treating employees fairly. And I didn't specifically say, because in this section of the Bible, it says to do that, because that's not welcome in much of the workplace. You drive people away. You can actually be called into HR on the carpet if you do much of that, right? So I didn't go quite that far, that specific. Unless somebody opened a door, you know, and there were people that either on my staff or their staff, or sometimes total strangers, would ask if they could meet with me over lunch or a cup of coffee or come into my office. And they would either have questions about the church, like I was some kind of an authority. I didn't think so. But I guess in their circles, they thought that that was something I could help them get some answers. Other cases, they just wanted to confide about a problem they were having raising children, or they were not getting along with their boss, or whatever. And so I just tried to handle those gently and not overtly Catholic in that regard. But it positioned me well in the workplace. My job and my career kept advancing, and so I would do more and more of that and become more and more obvious and overt in talking about Catholicism. And over time, I felt more comfortable doing that. So I would just say, if you practice it, practice makes perfect, right? So use your judgment and the receptivity. You don't want to be out there proselytizing and driving people away despite your good intentions. But there are opportunities, and we can let them pass by or we can grab onto them. So another example, this was about 10 years ago, pretty eventful day. Our company, a different company, we had just done a major acquisition. And that day, my role as the COO was to fly to this new plant that we acquired in Phoenix. We had acquired three plants. And so we sent people out, kind of like Jesus, you know, sent the apostles out two by two. There were three of us on this trip, but my HR director and my apprentice, who was the grandson of the owner, who was assigned to me to try to fix him. Right? He was a spoiled brat, 27 years old. He was raised by the owner of the company, his grandfather, and he had rolled, I believe, three sports cars before his mid-20s. And so he was just kind of tagging along, and you know, the assignment was, hang out with Jeff, and eventually you're going to learn how to be a good manager, right? And so he went everywhere with me. Went to India, went to Venezuela, traveled all over the world with me. Disciplinary situations, fire negotiations. But anyway, he's long. So the three of us are on this long flight, sitting in one row. And Josh leans over to me and he says, how long have you been married? At the time, I think it was 27, 30 years, something like that. And he said, 30 years. Just shook his head. He said, I don't think my marriage is going to last 2 years. And that was totally out of the blue. And I said, well, tell me more, Josh. What's going on? And he says, yeah, she's not the girl I dated. You know, she's different. And he confessed all her sins to me. And after, you know, I let him get all that off his chest, and I said, So what were your marriage vows? I said, what? I said, you know, at your wedding, you said a vow. He says, I don't remember. I just said whatever the priest said. So I was still hungover from the bachelor party the night before. And I said, I, Jeff, take you, Nancy, to be my wife. I promise to be true to you in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health. I'll love you and honor you all the days of my life. I said, Nancy, take this ring as a sign of my love and fidelity in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And his jaw just dropped. He didn't know what to say. And I said, nobody held a gun to my head. I was just not parroting what the priest said. That was my commitment. I made it to her parents, to her, to our future children, to our friends who were at the wedding. And you know, we recite those to each other every anniversary, but I recite it to myself every time I'm not happy, right? Every time, you know, it's one of those days, right? You've had them, right? But by doing that, I've decided, you know, marriage isn't a 50-50 proposition. This is what I told Josh. I said, it's not a 50-50 deal. There are times when I'm not carrying my share of the load. And there are times when I feel like I'm doing it all, right? And it's not fair, or I'm being talked to in a way that's not fair, or I'm just not feeling the love, right? And I said, those are the times when I go apologize, right? And even if I didn't start the fight, even if I didn't think I did anything wrong, my vows say that I'm going to love you and honor you always. And so I'm going to swallow my pride and go apologize and try to get things back where they need to be. And his marriage is still together. I'm going to take some credit for that because it was pretty rocky. But that witness, you know, and you can do it in your own way, but I don't know where that all came from. It wasn't expected or planned. And I hadn't done that before with others, but it made a difference to him. On the same flight, so hearing this whole conversation, the guy across the aisle is like E.F. Hutton, right? And the seats, one of them's reclined. I can see the lady in the seat behind us leaning forward. You don't know who's watching and who's listening. So you may think you're having one conversation that could be going somewhere completely different. But our HR director, who was on the trip with me, was from India, and she decided to chime in. She says, you know, I had an arranged marriage. That's from where I come from in India. That's the culture. She said, I met my husband the morning of our wedding. And that was my reaction. I said, wow, right? Oh, I always say that, you know, Nancy's brother and sister and her mother said, you knew her. You could have warned me. But no, you didn't. But she said, you know, we have a wonderful marriage. I think she said she had three kids and they grew to love each other. And she said, it works in our culture because we know that our parents only have our best intentions, or they only have the best intentions for us. They will not hook us up in a marriage with somebody who's not right for us. They care. They really do. And I said, that's a little bit like being Catholic, because we're called to be apostolic. We're supposed to accept the church's teachings, believe in them, trust in them, even if we don't fully understand them, because we know the church isn't trying to keep us from goodies, right? They only care about our best interests, and they love us just like parents do. So anyway, we completed our task for the day. We landed. We introduced ourselves at this new factory as, you know, the white knight that we just bought this failing company and we're going to invest a lot of money in it. And all went great. And so we wrapped up the day. We head out for dinner and we just went locally to the local sports bar that was in the hotel. So we're just sitting at the bar having, you know, a simple meal. And the conversation strikes up just as it did on the plane. So we're talking about marriage. We're talking about raising children and all this. And they're just really curious. They're pumping me like I'm like I know something, right? So we're just having an interesting conversation. And, you know, I was explaining a little bit more in detail about, you know, some of the things that I've been involved in. And this person decided that was a great time to intervene, right? We had talked about, I just recently come back from Rome. I made two trips to Rome and was telling them about the beauty of St. Peter's Cathedral. And I spent 5 days in Rome and I never left the cathedral. There's just so much to see there and just go deeper and deeper into what that whole structure is about and all the symbolism there. Talked about the Pietà, which is also in St. Peter's, and the beautiful sculpture that Michelangelo made of Mary receiving Jesus after he's taken down from the cross, and all that is embodied in that sculpture. I talked about the Holy Stairs. The Holy Stairs, if you're not familiar with that, it's just an incredible, it's Pilate's stairs. And it was St. Augustine's, Santa Scala. Okay, so we visited there, and the tradition for the pilgrims who visit there is, and these are the stairs that Christ walked up when he was being interrogated by Pilate, and there are blood stains that are on the marble and a wood covering on the floors. And when you arrive there, they hand you a pamphlet, and the tradition is that you kneel on the stairs. And there's, I don't know how many stairs, maybe 30 stairs. You kneel on the stairs and you recite this prayer. And then you go to the next stair and you do it again. And it takes, for most people, maybe 20 minutes to make it up the steps. And Nancy and I were there. The stairs were pretty much full. There were nuns. There were people that had to be in their 80s. There were young kids. Full variety of people in various stages in life. And so we got up to maybe the fourth or fifth stair. And I started having pain. I was really struggling with this. And so going up and I'm looking around, and I was in pretty good physical condition. There was no reason that I should be struggling with this. And I started having back pain. And I started having pain in my neck. And Nancy's leaning over because she could hear me like groaning and grumping. And it's taking a long time. It was very laborious to go up like to the fifth step. It should not have been a very, very big deal, right? I see these little nuns going right on. I go, what the heck is going on here? And so that continued the entire length of the stairs. I eventually made it, but probably took probably twice as long as everybody else to get up the stairs and recite this brief prayer. And as we came back down, I was feeling lightheaded and dizzy. I felt like I almost stepped off the curb into traffic. And she's like, what is going on with you? And I said, I have no idea. It was just very difficult. You know, it should not have been that difficult. And so later on, she showed me a travel book. I think it was from AAA, a magazine that came. And there was a witness there from somebody who had the exact same experience, and their conclusion, I think they took it to their spiritual director, and the conclusion was that you were blessed by getting a glimpse of the suffering that Christ had at that same time as he was being tortured and crowned with thorns and beaten. So I told that story at the bar. Okay. And then, you know, I talked about the incorruptibles, right? Talked about the Eucharist, and they were loving this. And I was, I wasn't like holding court, but carrying all these conversations. And then I decided that I would do a demonstration of why I'm pro-life, right?
Wow, come on. I don't believe in any of that garbage, pro-life. Such an outdated topic. I can't believe you believe that.
Yeah, interesting. Would you like to join us? I'd like to learn more. Come on up here. Let's talk. My name's Jeff, by the way.
I'm Anthony.
Anthony?
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
So you didn't believe in stuff. So you heard what we were talking about.
I did.
Okay. So can you tell me what it is you believe in?
I don't believe in any of that. It's so outdated. I believe in my own stuff.
Yeah, I'd like to learn more because I haven't heard what you believe in yet.
Well, I believe that people have choices and choose. Choose what they can do with their bodies, what they can, you know, have the freedom to choose. It's restricted. The belief is restricted.
So do you believe that there is a God or an intelligent design?
Don't really need to believe in that.
Okay. So do you believe that, I mean, where do you think we came from, the first humans?
Well, it's a good question. I don't really know.
So a lot of folks who don't believe in some of the teachings that I believe in would think, you know, there was a big bang, right? I've heard that it's popular. Do you think that's probably where we all started? Is some big bang somewhere?
I guess. I mean, a big bang,
Okay. So one of the questions that I've always had for folks who say that's how it all started is, okay, what happened right before that? Like the stuff that banged, where'd it come from? Like there might have been, like if you have a bomb, like there's ingredients, there's chemicals, or so like cosmic dust maybe. And when I say, where did that come from? They really don't have an answer for that. It was just there. Right?
Well, my professors taught me that it was just combination of chemical reactions and something that happened.
Got it. And those chemicals just come out of a lab somewhere?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. I was just going to do a little demonstration for my friends here. Would you? I'd like to hear your opinion on this.
Okay.
You got a second? You're done with your pool game over there?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. Awesome. So it's a whiskey glass that I borrowed from my friend Josh here. This is a baby. This is the mother. So in this primitive example, the baby's been born. Right? The baby is on the in the hospital, completely born, maybe 15 minutes ago. You think it's okay that somebody would kill that baby at that point?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if it was still attached by the umbilical cord, it's out on the table, it's been born. What do you think? Is it okay to kill that baby, even though it's still part of the mother at that point?
Well, that's a good proposition.
Mm-hmm. Most people would say not. Most people would say that baby's been born. Very, very few. Even the most, only the most extreme folks would say that baby could be killed. Right? But I get curious is if you back up in space and time a little bit, now let's say baby's kind of partially born, right? Maybe just the head crowning, one of the appendages starting to be born. Again, most people, very, very strong majority would say, not okay to kill that baby under any circumstances, that both lives should be in the care of the doctors at that point. And if you work your way back in time, some folks who are pro abortion would say, well, as long as it's not in the last trimester, it's okay to kill the baby. And I would say to that, so last trimester is months 7 through 9. What about month 6 and 29 days? It's not in the last trimester. Anyway, see what I'm doing here. Work your way back.
Yeah.
And folks who are, when you get into the higher percentage of the folks who are pro-abortion, they would say, well, within the first trimester, it's not fully developed, maybe it's not viable on its own, so it's very early in pregnancy, it's okay to feel that bit. There's more people that think that. And what I would say is, so you're drawing the line there at the first trimester. Well, what about 15 minutes before that? Right. It seems kind of arbitrary, right? If you're dealing this with geography or with time, it seems pretty arbitrary, not real scientific for those who propose a scientific solution or that. So I would say within that pregnancy at any point, you can debate when life begins, but I would say there's one definitive moment, right? That before conception, there's no life. But at any time after conception, you can't tell me a specific time. Whether it's a heartbeat, that seems arbitrary. Whether it's viable outside the womb, that seems arbitrary because that's a moving target as medical advancements continue. Babies are born earlier and earlier and survive with care. So that's kind of the demonstration. So what are your thoughts on that?
It's a very good demonstration. Gives me some things to think about. Definitely haven't dove too far into this. Yeah, thanks for
you think your professors have any answers, those wise, all-knowing professors of yours?
They might have answers. They might differ from yours. You've given me some, some provoking things to think about here.
Good. Well,
thank you.
I'm glad you stopped by.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you. Okay. So Anthony is obviously not an atheist. He was our lecturer in the first two masses. He's a regular attendee at our home-based community meetings and has added so much youth vitality in life. And he's recently engaged. So congratulations, Anthony. Thanks for being my spoil there.
You're welcome.
Thanks. That was one day in my life that I just went through. And I didn't seek any of those things out. But all true stories, I've relayed them many times to my family, just like they happened yesterday. A couple closing thoughts here as we wrap up. I know we're pressed for time. There's resources available, right? Presentation Ministries has a wealth of resources, a lot of literature. Father Al's teachings on the entire Bible are available online on the Presentation Ministries website. There's so many resources available now to us. If you ever feel stumped on one of the church's teachings, or if you're in a situation you don't feel equipped, go to CatholicAnswers.com, the apologetics. If you pray over it, you do some research with the official church teachings on these controversial topics can equip you to do battle with an atheist or do battle with an anti-Catholic co-worker. And maybe you don't win them over completely, but if you create a seed of doubt, that's what you're called to do, and that they can take it from there. Nancy mentioned Father Mike Schmitz, the daily podcast with the catechism in a year. Or the Bible in a year, it takes about 15, 20 minutes a day. Work it into your schedule. I work it into my morning breakfast and commute, and then I'm just listening to sports podcasts the rest of the day. But do that. You will not regret using those resources. We're supposed to start a small group. So I have to leave you with the closing reflection on prayer, and I'll do it fast. Radiant Magazine, it's another one of those Catholic resources. I found it online. There's an author, her name is Luba Sigwa. I've never heard of her before, but she wrote on this topic. She said, she was talking about spirituality. She said, yes, God has plans for you, big plans, amazing plans, plans that are way bigger and better than what you could possibly hope for yourself. And she said, I was having brunch with a friend recently, and we were getting ready to part ways. I asked her to pray that I would discern God's will. She looked at me and said, I will not. She said, Mother Teresa told someone who gave her the same request, I won't pray that you discern God's will. I pray that you'll have trust. Her words really stuck with me because she was right. Trust is the key. Your job is not to figure out your whole life. and agonize over every little choice you have to make. Your job is to trust. So I want to leave you with that thought. We're going to break into small groups, and Nancy has some instructions for how we're going to do that, right? And this is going to be a little bit different. Previously, it was question discussion. We just showed you a role play, so that's what you're going to do. So you want a smaller group, maybe three people max.
So these discussion questions are asking you to, you know, defend Catholic teachings with somebody. And so the directions say, being Catholic is more than engaging in intellectual debates about church teachings. It can be stressful, though, to be put on the spot when these discussions present themselves. So it's worth practicing in a safe environment to defend one's faith and not remain quiet and not leave people in a state of confusion or error about church teachings. In your small group, try to role play these apologetic situations in a loving way using one or more of the following topics. So